Well, good evening. So good to be together this evening. Appreciate all you who have come our way tonight to finish up this series with us. Grateful for this week. There's so much I could say about these saints here in Pontiac and the encouragement that they have been to Cassie and to me this week, but I'll just leave it at that. They've been a great encouragement to us, and I'm so grateful to God for each and every one of you here, and also for all of you who have visited this week and have encouraged us as well. It's been a great week, and I thank God most of all for that. This evening brings us to the final lesson in this series that we've been calling One God, One Story. And that means we've been through seven books of the Bible already and are slated to tackle the eighth in our final lesson tonight. And I realize that we've had enough lessons that recapping all those is going to take a little bit of time. However, we have a lot of people with us who haven't been with us so far in this series, and we're grateful that you're here. So we'll take just a minute and do a little recap as we get started as to what we've been through to set up the book of Ruth, where we'll be tonight as we conclude. We started the series, of course, in the book of Genesis, in Genesis chapter 17 specifically. The goal of the series is to kind of help us connect each book of the Bible to the overall biblical narrative, so picking one passage from each book to do that. So Genesis 17 was the first of those. We talked about the sign of the covenant, and we learned about God, that he is a God who seeks a covenant relationship with his people. And then in that covenant relationship, he makes great covenant promises, incredible promises, and yet he has also set forth covenant expectations of his people as part of that covenant as well. And then in the book of Exodus and also in the book of Leviticus, we saw that both of those books kind of share a theme of where God is a God who divides and who names. God separated or divided his people from Egypt and named them as his own, his people, God's people. And then Leviticus shows them that he wants them to stay that way. He wants them to stay separated and stay his people. And then in the book of Numbers, we looked in chapters 13 and 14 about the unfaithful report of the spies and learned that God's people always have to choose to fight when he commands it. They can't shrink back and be faithless. Otherwise, physical in the case of Israel and spiritual in the case of us, disaster awaits. But we also saw that victory is certain when you fight on the Lord's side. And then in Deuteronomy, we looked at the greatest commandment in chapter 6 of Deuteronomy. We saw that this is really the call for God's people of all time, in all cultures, all places, to love him most of all, and how that applies to us as well. And then Wednesday night, we looked in Joshua chapter 24 at the renewal of the covenant that Joshua calls Israel to in that chapter. And we saw that he's really calling Israel to consider their spiritual history. He reminds them of all that God has done. And then he shows them how that ought to motivate them to serve him alone, to choose to serve God alone. And that's where we get that famous statement in verse 15 of chapter 24 that Joshua says, "You can choose who you'll serve. As for me and my house, we're going to serve the Lord." And he challenges them to do that service to God in both sincerity and in faithfulness as well. And we looked at the idea of how those things don't have to be mutually exclusive. God wants our heart and he wants our faithfulness, our obedience to his commands. And then in Judges chapter 2 last night, we consider the downward spiral of departure from God and saw how incomplete obedience can never lead to complete deliverance. Israel would cry out to God, but their hearts weren't really in it. And of course, they were not ultimately delivered because of that. And ultimately, incomplete obedience, we saw, leads to dire spiritual consequences, not just for us, but even for our families, for our children, and even our grandchildren and beyond. And the next book in the Bible is a little bit more positive in the book of Judges, and that's where I want to end tonight, in the book of Ruth, with a story that is indeed a story of redemption. Now, Ruth is fascinating for a lot of reasons, I think, but maybe the most immediately apparent reason is that it's just a nice story. It's a nice break from what just came before it. Encountering difficulty, feeling hopeless, those are things that we are familiar with too. Now, those are things that Ruth dealt with in her time, that Naomi dealt with in this story. And they're things that, as I look out, I know many of you have faced in your lives, feeling hopeless, encountering a lot of challenges that come our way. And it cannot but be encouraging and refreshing to see that when Naomi and Ruth find themselves in that kind of situation, that God delivers them. God delivers them from that. He provides redemption for them. And so along those lines, let me just quickly give a basic overview of the plot of the book of Ruth to kind of give some context to the passage near the end of the book where I want us to spend most of our time tonight. The story begins when we meet Elimelech and Naomi. They are Jews from Bethlehem who have two sons. When a famine comes to Israel, their family moves to Moab in order to survive. However, Elimelech, the patriarch, soon dies. Naomi is left with only her two sons. And so those sons, both of them, each subsequently marry a Moabite wife. All seems to be well with that. But then after 10 years, both of Naomi's sons died, leaving these three women, Naomi and her two daughters-in-law, without a man to provide for them, which in that culture would have been a significant problem. And after this happened, Naomi hears that God had given his people food back in the land of Israel. And so she begins the process of going back to her homeland, of returning to Israel, which was the promised land given to God's people. And so she tells her two Moabite daughters-in-law to return to their families and find new husbands. And she wishes them the best. She wishes them success in that endeavor. One of her daughters-in-law, named Orpah, not Oprah, as my autocorrect seems to have changed it to, but Orpah, make no mistake there, kisses Naomi and departs. And she leaves. But her other daughter-in-law, Ruth, will not leave her side and makes the famous statement that a lot of us are familiar with from this book, "Where you go, I will go, and where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God." And of course, the reason this is so remarkable is that Ruth actually isn't an Israelite. She's not one of those covenant people of God. She's a foreigner to God's people, and yet she still makes this assertion, "Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God." So Ruth, having made her choice, off they go, she and Naomi, to Israel. Yet upon arriving, still, they're without a man to provide for them. And as such, they remain dependent on the Mosaic Law's provision for those who are poor, that they be allowed to glean the leftovers from Israelite fields after the reapers had gone through and picked up what they were able to take. But as the rest of the book unfolds, of course, God provides for Ruth in the form of what is called a kinsman redeemer. That's one who is obligated by the statutes in Leviticus chapter 25 to pay or to make up for the loss that a family member suffered. That's kind of the general concept. They were to make up for that kind of loss. In this case, Ruth had lost one to provide financially for her, but also to provide the possibility of children for her. And so by God's kindness, Ruth meets Boaz, who redeems her and shows love to her. And just like that, by God's grace, Naomi and Ruth are now redeemed. Perhaps now you see the connection to the songs that Andy led us in. Maybe you already did. But they're now redeemed. They are cared for. They have regained the hope and the comfort that they lost when they lost their husbands. And the reason I wanted to go through that is that all those events are key in bringing us to chapter 4, verses 13 through 17, where we see the outcome of all that has happened throughout the narrative of the book. And when we get to chapter 4 and verse 13, Boaz has just agreed to redeem Ruth. And he's made arrangements with the one nearer relative who is also qualified. But Boaz made arrangements that he's going to be the one to redeem Ruth. And so having made those arrangements, verse 13 of Ruth chapter 4 begins. "So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. And he went into her, and the Lord gave her conception, and she bore a son. Then the women said to Naomi, 'Blessed be the Lord, who has not left you this day without a redeemer. And may his name be renowned in Israel. He shall be to you a restorer of life and a nourisher of your old age. For your daughter-in-law, who loves you, who is more to you than seven sons, has given birth to him.' Then Naomi took the child and laid him on her lap and became his nurse. And the women of the neighborhood gave him a name, saying, 'A son has been born to Naomi.' They named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David." The book of Ruth is, in my humble opinion, one of the easiest books in the entire Old Testament to understand in terms of how it fits into the biblical narrative and how it connects to the gospel story that we read about in the New Testament. And of course, that's kind of the stated purpose of this series. So I think it's easy to see that connection. But because it's so clear how the book fits in, I want to try to emphasize this evening not only how the story of Ruth fits into the overall biblical narrative, but also how the story of Ruth shows us how we fit into the overall biblical narrative, or at least how we ought to. But let's start off big picture as we look at Ruth chapter 4 to help us find these connections. First of all, I suggest this to you. Ruth points us back to God's promises and covenant. One of the amazing things about the book of Ruth is that despite the fact that the events described actually take place during, guess what period? The period of the judges that we talked about last night. It was so depraved and so wicked and so far from God. That's where all this takes place. And yet, God is still keeping his covenant and his promises. In fact, the very first verse of Ruth lets us know right off the bat, all this really did take place during the time when the judges ruled Israel. And again, as I'd imagine you're all well aware of, this is a time when Israel had rejected God. As we looked at last night, the period of the judges was an era during which God's chosen people drifted further and further and further away from him in this continual downward spiral as they go down that cycle further and further. But looking back to where the series started, in the book of Genesis, in chapter 12, God promised Abraham that he would give him a land, that he would give him descendants, and would also bless all the earth through him. And then in chapter 17, God makes the covenant with Abraham and with his offspring, on the condition that Abraham and his offspring keep that covenant and in return, responding to God's covenant faithfulness in kind, with covenant fidelity on their part. Unfortunately, when we get to the period of the judges, Israel's about as far from covenant fidelity, faithfulness, as we could possibly imagine. But even in that context, the story of Ruth sends a message to Israel and to us who read it today. And the message it sends is that even though Israel deserved to be abandoned by God, he did not abandon them. Even though they had abandoned him and been unfaithful to his covenant, God was far more merciful, far more patient with them than they could even dream of deserving. And he did not abandon them, but he continued to show himself faithful despite their being so faithless. Despite having every right to do so, Ruth shows us that God had not rejected Israel, but was still willing to be faithful to his covenant and to keep his covenant promises that he had made as far back as in Genesis. So yeah, this first application is actually looking backwards. We're at the point now where we need to look backwards to see Ruth's role in the whole biblical story, because there's still a lot ahead of us, but a lot behind us as well. And God is showing us that even when Israel is unfaithful, he is not, and he has not forgotten all that he promised, even to Abraham so long ago. Just as God promised to Abraham that he would give him land, he would give him great descendants and bless the earth through his seed. Through Boaz's redemption, Ruth receives land. She's given descendants where she previously had no hope of any, as we see in verse 13 of chapter 4. And through her seed comes not only David, but even Jesus himself. Wow. How's that for covenant faithfulness? Now, the ultimate lesson that we can see from all this, at least that I want to point out to you now, is that even in this dark period, those who are seeking God and being faithful to him find him to be a faithful God who has never forgotten his promises to his people. And such continues to be true throughout the entire biblical story. But the story of Ruth does not only point us back to God's giving of the Abrahamic covenant near the beginning of the Bible, but even more so, Ruth points us forward to Christ and even to us. I think we first see this in Boaz, in kind of how he acts in this story. Boaz is, at his heart, sacrificial. Boaz is very sacrificial. There was actually a closer relative than Boaz, who was also a potential kinsman redeemer for Ruth. And yet he didn't redeem her because of the cost. See that in verse 6 of chapter 4. The Redeemer said, I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I impair my own inheritance. Take my right of redemption for yourself, for I cannot redeem it. So clearly, this type of redemption that Boaz is engaging in with Ruth would put a drain on the finances of the Redeemer. That's just the reality of this whole thing. And we can understand that. Cassie and I just added a child to our family, and our budget has changed as a result of that. We've got categories in there that we never had before. I had to adjust some things, shift some things around. And looking at people with much larger families than one child here tonight, and they definitely understand how that works. So imagine, though, not just an infant, but a full-grown woman and all her needs. But not even just that, an aging mother-in-law as well. I mean, who wants to sign up for that? Take on the mother-in-law? No offense. Man, maybe I should have thought through that one a little more there. Anyway, mother-in-laws are great. But, in all seriousness, really, who wants to sign up for that? Based on the responsibilities alone, much less considering that their financial needs would be his sole responsibility. But Boaz shows himself impressively quite unfazed by that. It doesn't shake him. He appears so determined to redeem Ruth from the moment she reveals her relation to him and her need to be redeemed. He's determined. He's going to be the one to do it. Boaz never complains throughout the entire narrative. He consistently sacrifices for Ruth and provides for her despite her inability to do anything for him, really. And in making such sacrifices and offering such service to Ruth, Boaz shows himself to be an image, a shadow of Christ himself. What does Christ do for us? He sacrifices for us, primarily, despite great cost. He sacrifices for us, no matter our inability to do anything for him. He sacrifices for us, no matter our baggage, no matter what we bring to the table and we need him to deal with as well. And it's just such a beautiful picture that Boaz shows us. I'm not saying Boaz was perfect, but that's not the point. What Boaz does is he does a good job of filling the role of simply being that signpost, of being a shadow that points to Christ, who is perfect and who is the greatest sacrificial redeemer there ever was and ever will be. But as amazing of a picture of Christ as Boaz shows us, just by the fact that he is this sacrificial redeemer, the even more amazing thing is that he does this despite the fact that, don't forget, Ruth is a foreigner. She's not an Israelite by birth. She was not born into being God's people. From everything I can tell, it's questionable whether or not Boaz even had any kind of an obligation to Ruth at all, at least under the letter of the law of Leviticus 25. That law was clearly for Israelites, people who were born into God's covenant people, not for foreigners, not for sojourners. But nonetheless, Boaz chooses, adamantly chooses, determinedly chooses to redeem Ruth, a foreigner, without apology and without reservation. And as he does so, he becomes a shadow of what God will do through Jesus in extending that offer of redemption to all the nations. Ruth herself specifically shows us that even though we are not part of physical Israel, if we will adopt the mantra that she adopted, that Israel's God will be our God, and God's people will be our people, God will provide redemption for us too, despite our unworthiness and our inability to do anything for him. On paper, there's nothing about Ruth that merited, that demanded Boaz's redemption of her. And yet, that's exactly what he did. He did redeem her and gives us hope. And as much as in this story, we are Ruth and Jesus is Boaz, God has provided for our redemption as well, undeserving though we are. So this story truly does point us forward to Christ and to us as well, because ultimately, this story is the gospel story. And that's, I think, where its true beauty lies. But another key thing that the account of Ruth, and specifically the redemption and the marriage of Ruth by Boaz, described in chapter 4, shows us is this. Even when those around us seem to have all forsaken God, we can still be righteous. Even when everyone around us seems to have gone far away from God as they can get, we can still be who God wants us to be. As we've already noted, this is during the time period of the judges. Back to verse 1 of chapter 1. You know, we think our time is bad. And I don't think we're wrong to think that. In Western culture, I think we're in a pretty rough spot in the history of the world in terms of evil and the wrong that goes on. People have rejected God, and of course that never ends well. It never ends well for individuals, certainly doesn't end well for families, and it doesn't end well for the nation as a whole. And so we see people confused about all kinds of things, confused even about their very gender. We see people treating each other abysmally, not as if they're created in the image of God. We see war. We see families breaking apart right and left. So yes, undoubtedly, our world today is quickly crumbling under the consequences of its own sin and rejection of God. But compared to what went on during Judges, as bad as our day is, I think Judges might truly be even worse. Reading Judges will make you sick to your stomach if you're actually reading it. At the absolute depravity that characterized Israel during that time, Judges records things I don't even want to speak about in a sermon. For example, all that took place in Judges chapter 19. It's despicable. At a loss for words to describe how depraved the nation was at that point. So yes, our day is bad, but Judges, probably even worse. What the book of Ruth shows us is that even in a time like that, people can still choose to be righteous. Just because the nation in general has forsaken God and gone down this path of depravity doesn't mean we can't choose to be different and to be holy, to be righteous, and to be obedient to God, all that he wants of his covenant people. We can still be that. The Israelite nation described in Judges is defined by instance after instance of faithlessness and sin and rebellion and depravity. But Boaz and Ruth show us that just because the nation is defined and marked by sin and immorality, we don't have to be. And I'll even take it a step further in applying this principle to us. Even when the nation in which we live is defined and marked by sin and immorality, we must not be defined and marked by sin and immorality. Yes, it's depressing. I get it. It's depressing to live in a nation where the leaders are corrupt. We get that as Illinois residents, right? The leaders are corrupt and sinful behavior is rampant and out of control. But Ruth shows us there is a way for godly people to handle that. And it's to choose to live differently. The narrative of this book serves as a reminder that godly individuals, not doing anything grandiose, nothing crazy that they'd make a movie about necessarily, or nothing earth-shattering, but godly individuals simply doing what is right, in spite of the depravity of the world around us, can actually accomplish a whole lot of good. And Ruth shows us that the reality is, even when it may seem like there are no others in the nation as a whole who are being true to God's covenant and to his laws, even when we think we must be alone in that, maybe we're actually not as alone as we feel. Reading the account of Judges, you wouldn't think there was anybody left who was righteous and doing anything in line with God's covenant. But there was. There was someone. And so in every generation, I think the Bible continually shows us, this is another part of the biblical narrative, the Bible continually shows us that in every generation there is a remnant. There is a remnant. And Ruth and Boaz prove that point in their generation. And in doing so, they give us hope for ours as well. But when there's a remnant of people who are faithful and obedient, there's something even more amazing that happens. And that is that even in a wicked nation, when people make that choice, when they choose to be faithful to God, God can and will be glorified through that. Notice what the women of the neighborhood, as they're described in verse 17, say to Naomi. They say to her, "Blessed be the Lord who has not left you this day without a redeemer." Well, hold on. I thought Boaz was the one who did the redeeming. He's the one who stepped up and made it happen and said, no, I'm going to redeem her, even when it didn't make a lot of sense necessarily for him to do that. I mean, shouldn't they be saying, wow, thank goodness for Boaz who came along and redeemed you. What a great guy. I mean, this is the guy. We ought to be talking about him around the neighborhood. Pretty solid stuff, am I right? That might make more sense on the surface. We know that in actuality, the neighborhood women actually got it right. They really did. The Lord is the one to be praised, because ultimately, what Boaz did was he just followed God's law. He followed the spirit of God's law, and he applied God's principles in a way that was consistent with God's own character, which is what he calls all his people to do at all times. And really, as we continue to go down that path, what I think we'll find is that the key characters of Ruth are really just filling what are actually mere supporting roles in this story. As God is praised for his redemption, and God is shown to be the true key character of this entire narrative. Even though Boaz and Ruth are noteworthy, godly people, good examples, no doubt, yet they just kind of fade into the background as we realize they were actually just imitating God and his ultimate character and following after the example of his nature. And what I hope that we can see from this, even though, you know, we call it the story of Ruth, and it's really not Ruth's story at all, it's God's story. The story of what he can do, of what he has done, and what he will continue to do for all those who seek him, who submit to him as their God, and for all those who live in his image. Just as Ruth and Boaz were able to glorify God simply by living out his covenant in the midst of an ungodly people, the same can be true for us today. If we make the choice to be different, to be faithful to God, despite a faithless nation around us, what will ultimately happen is God will be glorified. And we can take great comfort in that as God's people. From what we can see, it seems clear that Ruth and Boaz are not acting out of a desire to become some great heroes. They're not trying to go down in the record books of Israel so that everyone will know, Ruth and Boaz, what great people. That's not their goal. They're just doing what God has asked of all his people, keeping his covenant and following his law. And likewise, I don't think we ought to view the task of living as God's people today as some sort of heroic effort where we become big name disciples. Oh, yeah, that guy. Wow. You know him? Okay. No, we're not trying to be looked up to by other Christians. We're not trying to stage some massive revolution of our own. Rather, we need to make it our aim to act out of a simple belief that God is sovereign, and our task, no matter what is going on around us, is to keep his new covenant, which he made with us through Jesus, and to follow all that his grace demands of us under that new covenant. If we'll do that, God can and will be glorified, and we will have fulfilled our purpose for existing on this earth. We'll have done everything we were made to do. And we will have fulfilled that purpose even in spite of a world that encourages us to run away from our God-given purpose of glorifying him. Brothers and sisters, let's make that our aim. Let's make that what we're about. Not to be grand heroes of any kind, but to be faithful followers of God, keepers of his covenant, doers of his word, no matter what happens around us, no matter what comes our way. I don't know what's going to happen in the next 10, 20, 30 years, but I know that's true. That if we will be faithful to God, if we will choose to be different and just be faithful in our covenant relationship with God, he'll be glorified. And he has done and will do amazing things through his people. Boaz redeemed Ruth from the loss of provision, the loss of hope of offspring that she had experienced. And he did so. He did so sacrificially. He redeemed her at the cost of a significant portion of his finances. But Jesus has redeemed us from the loss of our relationship with God, doing so sacrificially and then at even greater cost, the cost of his life. He gave his own life up in order that we might have eternal life with God. And I hope you've seen through this series that that is what everything we've studied in the Old Testament this week has been pointing to. That's what all these shadows are about. Now, all these things, the Old Covenant, God's dividing and naming, God's covenant expectations, even the failed deliverers raised up in the book of Judges, and certainly the image of Boaz, the Redeemer, in the book of Ruth, they're all shadows of the true realities that we now experience as new covenant people. Aren't you thankful to live under that covenant? Isn't that amazing? To live the new life that we get to live in Jesus, what a privilege. What a blessing. Aren't you grateful that we can study all this, look at these shadows, look at these imperfect types, and then look at what we get to experience today and realize that we are blessed to live the fulfillment of all those things in Christ? It's incredible what we get to be a part of in Jesus. Thanks be to God for such an indescribable gift. I appreciate so much the invitation to be with you this week. It really has been so, so good, so needed, so good for our souls. And we'll take that encouragement back with us to the work in Sycamore. Thankful so much for the kindness that you all have shown to me and to Cassie and even to Ryder. So we're grateful for our time this week. I hope these lessons have been helpful to you. I hope they've encouraged you, and especially what we talked about tonight, to continue fighting the good fight, no matter what happens. Keep being faithful to God, and he'll be glorified. May the Lord bless you and keep you.